I'm Dana Carvey.
I'm David Spade.
Fly on the Wall's back for another season now on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
So many incredible guests will be joining us.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Too good to be true.
Sabres Live is presented by Seneca Resorts and Casinos. Nothing else comes close.
Hello. Welcome to day two of this return to the airwaves of Sabres Live. And it's Thursday, so
this is the real hump day for us.
This is our
the middle
hump
day.
It's still sunny, a little bit cooler, but that's fine. Everything's fine. Unless you're Montreal.
Everything is fine. Not everything is fine up there.
If they did an audit on shot attempts from last night's game, do you think they would have found that Carolina actually had more than a 95-45 edge?
This or that. Would Montreal get to 50 shot attempts at any games that could be played game 5, 6, 7, whatever?
Yeah.
It has been just a domination by Carolina.
Yeah, it's
right
typical
now.
Carolina. And you know what? We have a special guest to come in and join us here on the show today. This is amazing. This is our first repeat customer in studio. Can you believe that?
Yeah,
and what a guy to be able to say that about head coach Lindy Ruff.
And the first on the fly line change we've ever had on Sabres Live as well.
I think it was legit. Not too many at all. We're good.
I'm just fortunate to be with you guys.
Oh, and he comes in with a compliment of sorts. I love this.
This is a quote. We'll put it on the board. I'm just fortunate to be here. Just happy to be here. We were going to start with some world championship news because obviously Canada, USA are playing right now. Finland's playing. Konsta Helenius set a goal today. He's playing, like, assisted by Barkov. Are you watching the world championship for those guys?
I have not been watching. I've been watching a lot of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yeah.
But
yeah. There's the goal at 2-on-1, right? Like, we've seen Helenius in this situation before, but look at the play by Barkov. Oh, give it to Helenius for the one-timer. Just like we've seen before, boom, back at the net.
Yeah, I mean, he scored one of those in the Montreal series and probably could have had two more.
Yeah.
You know, we had that opportunity even in Game 7 with, Thompson and Benson, almost similar to that. So, great pass and great shot. Helly had, it was a great showing by him in that Montreal series.
Great showing really throughout the entirety of his second year as a pro. He did everything in Rochester to get himself the multiple opportunities with the Sabres. Now he's on the world stage. That's his first of the world tournament. He's got 3 points in the four games. As Finland looks good right now, they're up 3-1. Since we started with Konsta, kind of unintentionally, why don't we talk about how you look at moving forward with young players like he and Östlund as examples, and Jiří Kulík, of course, and what you think your center depth looks like already. I know we're not even in June yet, and it's just the appetite, Lindy. We had, had a poll yesterday and people's priorities and things like as you would expect. The appetite for your next game is already so high, and people are just wanting to know what's next.
Yeah, well, let's start with Konsta. Any young player, first of all, they get to dictate when they're here and when they get to stay, just by their play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you look at Austin when his first time up midway through the year, and where he ended up, and really what I feel was a real big loss to us when we lost him in the Boston series. Real good two-way player, one of our best defenders in our own end, the positioning really sound. And then we can move on to Konsta, who, was having a good year in Rochester. With Östlund's absence, we felt we needed, maybe that one more offensive guy that could help us out. Little worried, will he be able to handle the big stage, playing center, in the playoffs? And I felt he didn't really skip a beat through the playoffs and skated well. His physicality, his defending was good. And like I said, they get to make that decision. They come in, they play really well. Usually they push somebody out and they say, I'm here to stay. You look at him now on the world stage, playing the world championships and playing so well. Yep. I'm not surprised.
Yep.
Because he played with a really good group of players here. He played against a really solid team, and he played really well.
So the middle, though, because Jiří could play center, Östlund can play center, Konsta can play center. are you looking at this is great because we have all these centers that can play there? Or you're like, this is getting crowded in the middle of the ice, and there's obviously decisions that will need to happen for us to have our best lineup together?
I actually look at it that it's great. Okay. That it you can always have, you know, wingers that you can't move into center, but you can have centers that you can always move to the wing. And you look around the league, that like center depth. If you have center depth, you're in a real good place. There's a lot of teams that are screaming, boy, we need a third line centerman, we need a second line centerman. It's easy to move. We could take a Kulik, who hopefully should be healthy and was a real good player. Yeah. You could move him to the wing. Tomer could easily go back to the wing. We know that line of Benson, Kulik, and Thompson, you know, a year ago, the last 20 games was one of our best lines. They played against every top line, and they were a plus line almost every night. Yeah. You could take Helenius, and he could go to the right side. He doesn't necessarily have to play in the middle. He's playing on the right now, I think, with Barkov in the World Championship. So taking a center and pushing him outside is a great problem to have. And I think anytime you can have the depth we have, it's a great problem to have.
Of course, players are always answering these questions, you know, what do you prefer? And we, it has been almost since Tage's arrival here in Buffalo, right? Center wing. And there have been times where it seems like he's more preferential to the center ice, but you made that decision in the playoffs at a critical time. Norris became a center and Thompson was on the wing. Like, how did that all unfold for you, and how does it help, you know, shape, you know, when you're looking at your big board and manipulating line combinations and things like that? Do you feel like Tage is now just this fluid option for you in either spot?
I think in his heart he prefers center. You know, I think you look at that line and there was a dip in their play, like they weren't producing. It was time for a change. Yeah. And I think any time during the year, you know, when things go a little bit stale, the opportunity I have is, you know, you can put Thompson on the wing, you can move a few pieces around. And I think he instantly got rewarded. I think there was times, energy-wise, playing in our own zone, that it was better just to have him on the wing and put a guy that, you know, a little bit more speed down low, a little bit more quickness down low. And it freed him up, actually, to create a little bit more on the offensive side.
Now, when you look at patience as a head coach, like the changes you made to the lineup happened in Game 6. That was a great game in Montreal, the 8-3 win. I'm looking at, you know, even Marty St. Louis with Montreal right now. Waited until the second period yesterday to put Newhook with Suzuki and Caulfield because those two are struggling a little bit. What's that like for a coach? The difference between the regular season and being patient, knowing, hey, you know what, like, we have three games this week, and we can kind of see what's going to work or not, or the playoff decision to know when to be patient and when to not be patient and make some changes.
Well, I think there's two things. You have this, you know, you have this booklet that's full of stats and analytics, and what is a line giving you versus what are they giving up? First, you use that. You know, I think every coach has his own belief on what a good line is, whether he's that line is playing against other teams' top lines or whether it's playing against their top defensive pair. What are they giving us? So you use that information instantly. You know, myself with my group of coaches, which I think my assistant coaches do an incredible job. And then the one thing people don't realize, how incredibly hard they work.
Yeah.
So we'll sit as a group and we will talk about each line individually. And is it time for a change? I think sometimes coaches will hesitate, and I think you've known me for long enough that I don't have a lot of hesitation when it comes to pushing pieces around. And I've always been in the belief that a couple pieces will always stay together, and maybe it's just one guy that has to, whether it's a winger goes in to the other side or a winger goes to another line, or maybe we, you know, we push a centerman out and put him on the wing with somebody. But if the numbers don't say that this is a good line, then why would I keep playing that line together? Yeah. So we use a lot of that. We discuss that as our group of coaches. And usually, sometimes within the middle of a period or a middle of the second period in a regular season game, I just go, that this not working. We're going to try something different.
Can you give us a sense of what you and your staff have been doing? It feels like it's been a long time since the last game you played. It really hasn't. What have these most recent days been like for you and the staff?
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about, we've met and we talked a lot about the playoffs, and we've talked about how we need to get better. Mm-hmm. You know, and we'll continue to watch. Every guy will gather information on these, on what's going on right now. You'll take the Stanley Cup Finals and you'll look at both teams. I've probably spent more time just watching hockey every night. The hockey has been so good.
Yep.
That Colorado Vegas series really intrigued me.
Mm-hmm. From what standpoint the most?
Just, you got two really good teams. And then you take out a really good player. You take out a guy like Makar that's going to be missing for the first.
And MacKinnon.
And then now MacKinnon's a little bit hurt.
Yep.
Vegas, who, and there's something to be said about a team that gets on a good run. They put themselves in good position at last month of the year. Torts did an unbelievable job, came in. You look at the record since Torts has been there, and got to give him a lot of credit. Put the pieces in the right places. He's made a couple changes. He moved a couple pieces around on lines that is, that have made a big difference. And, you know, I saw an interview during the period or in between periods and the one after the game with Eichel when he said, you know, I haven't scored in a million years, whatever. But it's not about the playoffs. It really isn't about scoring. Mm-hmm. I think the playoffs become how hard can you check and how hard can you frustrate the other team.
Which Jack is really good at
yes.
now, too.
Well, he's a world-class skater, yeah. Number one. He's strong. But all those guys are bought into being world-class checkers now. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of – when you look at checking, you think checking. What is checking? Well, it's getting above the puck. It's being in the right place. It's keeping your shifts. It's managing the puck. There's all different levels of checking. That when we set out this year to be a better team, number one thing was we got to reduce goals against. Mm-hmm. We got to be a better defensive team. Are we there yet? We're a lot closer to where we want to be. I still think there's another level mm-hmm. to our club. We had some games where we were an incredibly tough team to play against, and incredibly hard to play against, where you take away time, you take away ice, your gaps are really good.
Game six in Boston.
Oh, for sure. It was like a clinic.
Your players eventually in the tougher games against Montreal, and Marty knows this, like when they started saying, like, we're just not tracking properly, but what they did in game six was tracking and everything else, like to go through that game without taking a penalty. To me, it was because of their instincts, their pressure, their positioning. Like, you're looking at a situation going, you could get in a bad spot here, but they were ahead of it. They just kept putting themselves in the best position to defend, and I was like, wow. What an impressive job that was. And I'm sure that's why you think you can get that even more, but it's still hard to say, Linda, you were the best team in the NHL from December 9th on.
I know, but we're going to keep saying it because we need to get better. Yeah. You know, we talk about, as a group of coaches, about getting better. What are we going to do to get better? And there's areas, part of our game is we're real good offensively. We've got world-class talent. I mean, we got some of the best players in the league that play on our hockey club. And part of that is they have to play, and they have to make big decisions on the ice. And I trust, I'm going to say 90% of the decision, okay? Because, you know, I get a little frustrated with the other 10%.
Yes, and there's always a 10%, but yes.
But let's game six reminds me of the game last night, the game that Carolina played. Mm-hmm. No time, no ice, no space, no chances. And a big part of playing good defense is if you're in good position, you don't take penalties. You're not reaching from behind. You're not in bad position. You don't have to slash somebody. That was a model game. I thought last night's game was a model game by Carolina. I thought that was the first time I thought Carolina looks like the real Carolina team. Uh-huh. They were fast. They defended hard. They took ice away. I thought they had Montreal totally frustrated.
Well, Carolina and Montreal are more of a man-to-man kind of defensive coverage. Vegas is a straight zone. Like, you look at those, it could be Carolina, Vegas. Who knows what's going to happen if Montreal comes back. But they are about as opposite of the spectrum in the way they defend. What do you like when you watch this? Do you tend one way or the other? What's that like?
Well,
I think X's and O's?
There's two parts when we watch X's and O's. You say man on man, yeah. Vegas is man-on-man when it comes to a certain point. When there's chaos, it's a collapse zone.
Yeah.
We are basically the same. You know, puck goes low to high, you're man-on-man, you find your man, you mark him, you're boxing out. If chaos breaks out, stay inside, don't run around, and wait for your opportunity for pressure. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at Montreal, what they did to us with all the shot blocking and staying inside, they're hard man-on-man, but when chaos broke out, I thought they did an unbelievable job. And give Marty St. Louis a lot of credit for this. Their guys sold out.
Yep.
They sold out to block shots, to be in shot lanes, to eliminate that extra opportunity.
Which is what Carolina is doing to Montreal now. They're keeping them to 12 shots, 13 shots. They have 25 block shots. And it's not just a block. It's getting a stick in the right position. And then all of a sudden, Suzuki's got a slot opportunity. But there's a guy that steps up with the stick, and that puck's deflected in the net.
Yeah. Well, you could look at the last goal that was scored against us. A stick in the right position puts a puck up in the up in the mesh, and that's the that's that next level that, and you might look at it and say, well, that's just one play. Well, the one play adds up to two plays, and those plays can make a world of difference in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm. Are you watching Montreal and Carolina right now, thinking how would we have been against Carolina? Or are you watching Carolina play against Montreal and saying, this is maybe what we should have done against Montreal? Like, which way do you, lean when you're watching that series?
I look at it more that if we were playing Carolina, what would we look like?
Yeah. And what does that look like?
That looks like it looks a lot like that 2-1 game we had in Carolina, which was a real tight-checking, hard-competing. You look at the hard-compete and guys going back, how quick Carolina gets back for pucks and how quick they get out of their zone. When we're on top of our game, we don't spend a lot of time in our zone. Mm-hmm. We try to play on a bigger piece of ice. Montreal plays a little different game where they'll bring pucks back. They'll throw a lot of pucks behind their net and try to get in a set breakout sometimes. Just a little different style, and they're good
Marty
at it.
Marty likes to slow it down.
Yeah, they're
good
like at it.
You don't like that.
Yeah, no, I don't like to slow it down, but part of their game is to... We're gonna bring it back, and we're gonna catch the other team reloading. And if you reload, we'll go back underneath, and we'll wait and get in a control breakout. And look at the year they had; they had a great year. So whatever you do, or whatever coaches want to do, get real good at it.
Yeah.
They're real good at what they do. You're looking collapse zone. If you're really good at it, be real good at it.
Yeah. Be the best at that.
That's right.
It's probably the wrong time to bring this out based on the shot differential last night between Carolina and Montreal, but Carolina's been doing this for years, right? Like, they seemingly are so far ahead in the shots on. And
they
travel
with their own statistician, Duffer.
Yes,
I keep saying that every time Carolina plays. I used to love playing in Carolina. I knew I was going to face 35, 40 shots.
Yeah.
It's like the guy is pressing the button four times for every shot, but now there's audit, and they're still doing it.
So I think fans sit there and they go, like, oh, my gosh, like, how do you close the gap? How do you compete continuously against a team like that? Like, how do you as a coaching staff look at what Carolina statistically does, you know, each night? And is it as hard to play against as what the stats might indicate?
It is.
Yeah.
It is, because they're really good at it.
Yeah.
They're really good at relieving pressure. They're really good at getting into the next zone. Their puck management, puck management is a lot of times is when you play them, they don't make a lot of the big mistakes. But they do. They're pretty hard man-on-man. You're coming into the zone. If they make a mistake, you're going to get a really good chance.
Yep.
Like, you look at the overtime game, the mistake, I think they got caught change or whatever. Suzuki walked in off the play. You're going to get a good look. They are really good. Rod has done a tremendous job. I think he's a great coach. He believes in what he's teaching. His team year after year is such a good team. And to look at where they're at and look at the number of pieces that have changed, number of good players that have been there and, you know, gone somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking really good players. You know, one went to Colorado. There's one in Dallas now. There's all kinds of good players. And it doesn't matter who comes inside of his system. Those players always look pretty good.
I remember playing here, and you talked about conditioning. We're going to be the best conditioned team in the league. And I'm looking now, third period of game three, Montreal had one shot on goal, and then they had one shot on goal in 10 and a half minutes of overtime. And last night in game four, even though Carolina's up 3-0, at one point the shots were 17-0 for Carolina. It ends up 19-3 in the third period. It feels like Carolina is a really good conditioned team, and maybe Montreal is tired right now. Are you like telling your guys still, like, we're going to be the best conditioned team so that we have juice in the third period to close out games and to play that way?
Yeah, you know, when you look at the whole and what it, now you're talking about a different group of coaches for us, our strength coaches, yep. And the guys that work in the back room, the guys that do all the work after games, before games, on days off where we're not skating, the work they do back there from Galley and his whole crew, Jake and Ray and everybody in the back. Our goal to start the season was to be one of the top conditioned teams. And obviously we had conditioning tests and we had a conditioning,
evaluation, because you can't say test.
Yeah, but last year you could.
Oh, yeah,
so we had
right.
tests last year.
But not this year.
And I'll just share this, and probably Mets won't like this, but Mets went through the conditioning skate and it didn't fare too well for him. And he goes, I can't believe how incredibly hard that was. Yeah. And I said, it is a hard test, but it does tell you where your engine is at.
Yeah.
Can you go out and repeat in 2 minutes? Can you go out and repeat the same shift you had 2 minutes ago? He said, don't worry. And he went down to Roch, played well, came back up, and we saw a pretty good Mensa.
Yeah.
And I still talked to him even late in the year. I said, hey, help with that conditioning skate. And, you know, him and I will share a laugh. But our players to a team with as much work then. I don't even know if people realize that there's game nights that some nights after the game, the players go in the back and have to work out.
Yeah.
And you think, boy, they just went through a game and now they go through a workout? Mm-hmm. Well, if they work out after the game as part of their game and their workout, then they get more rest if they come to the next day and now they don't have that. So Galley and his crew did a tremendous job, and I think every guy we talked to post-season was – we have to be the better conditioned team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it did show up this year. But I still think we got another level.
Yeah. Third period goal differential was phenomenal right near the top. Vegas, same thing. And Vegas has obviously continued to show that right now as they are into the Stanley Cup final. One thing that I thought was really enlightening from Yarmo at his end of season presser was talking about the goaltending and the use of three and how you guys are looking at it like, this is a new world we're going into with full-time e-bugs, and we had success with three. And like, can you believe we're kind of here at this point having a conversation like this? And now that you're a little bit removed from the season, like, how do you look at your goaltending? Obviously, again, fans, you know, wonder what's next for the goaltenders after everything that you know, you went through this year.
I'm going to just say I think our goaltending was one of our strengths in real important areas of the season. You know, different goalies, one of our three stepped up and won us a big game. You're looking late in the year, the game that Ellie stepped in and got a shutout. It's funny how it worked out, because there was times in the season where all of a sudden we're going to have three, it felt a little uncomfortable, then one guy got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So now one guy isn't practicing for about a month, and now we got two. And then we would just get healthy, we'd have about a week of three, and the next guy either had a back or had a groin or, you know, couldn't go full goal. And it really became our strength. In a year where, and Marty, you know this, just by travel, the schedule was ridiculous.
Yes.
I don't know if there could have been a better year to have three with the amount of games we had to play.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at, you know, some wondered, is it a good thing to have your starter and then your third guy be the backup so that you can rest the guy the next day? That's kind of new world, too, where, you know, he doesn't have to sit on a bench, doesn't have to get...
Maybe he gets a workout, and then he has more time to recover.
And he has more time to recover. So all that was new, and I think sometimes if you don't try something, you'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happened with us is we had three guys that really got along.
Mm-hmm.
And Marty, you've had the pads, and I think if the three guys don't get along, I don't think it works. It doesn't work. But these three guys, They all liked each other. They all pushed each other. They all cheered for each other. They all wanted each other to do well. I never saw two guys happier when Ellie got a shutout.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, damn, he got a shutout. Maybe now I'm on, maybe now I'm not going to play.
Right.
It was like, go get another one.
Yeah.
All of that worked. And I think Yarmo has nailed it. Now you have to have an e-bug. If you have to have an e-bug, you know, can you have that one extra spot for your goalie? And mm-hmm. I know it takes a slot, but that might be the new world.
I'm wondering, just because it's new, but we had that discussion maybe last week, Duffer, about, like, let's just say Colton Ellis, for example, as the third guy this year. I don't want to say he's the third guy going in next year, whatnot, but, you know, you're like, do you want to play maybe once a month, twice a month, and be in the NHL, or do you want to play 15 games at the AHL level and get yourself maybe seen or, you know, excel? Did you have that conversation with maybe Ellie or anybody else about, well, you know, you could be doing one thing or the other, but we like what's going on right now?
I like how you...
this or that. Like, yeah.
It's kind of your thing.
Yeah. Because I was asking myself the question, what would I have wanted? Let's right. just say year three, I come up to Buffalo.
What would have you wanted, Marty? What would have you wanted?
Well, early on, going? I would have won the paycheck, and I would have said, I want to be in the NHL. But then after that, you're like, well, I just don't want to be just an NHL guy. I want to be a number one. I want to play. How does that work? So I think it would have been a tough kind of thing to handle in yeah. that moment.
I think you're right. I think that the goalies will make decisions for us again, I think, on how well they play. And I don't think they're outside of that where Consta, Hellenius is, you know, where Austie was. You know, they'll come in, they'll either play really well and we'll say, boy, we might have to stay with this guy.
Yeah.
Or we might just say, boy, they're, you know, we're getting good games out of everybody. It's working for us again. But I think they get to make that decision for us. And, you know, you look at games. There's games sometimes a goalie can give up. Maybe he gives up four goals. And maybe there's nothing he could have done about all four.
Yeah.
And then there's games, you know, you can play really well defensively, and that might have been a lot easier game than the next guy plays.
Right.
So I think sometimes, you know, we break it down. We look at the A chances you give up, the B chances you give up. You know, did he face a tough night? You know, so there's a lot of factors that go into, you know, how we evaluate how a goalie played.
Can you give us a sense just of what's ahead here with the combine and getting ready for the draft and getting ready for free agency and getting this roster ready for next year? And maybe even tie it into just what it's like now in your involvement and relationship with Yarmo compared to 20 years ago, because we talked so much about 05, 06 and 06, 07 this past season because of the similarities and what your relationship was like with Darcy at that point in building and conversing about every aspect of this
yeah,
team.
Yeah, you know, I think it a lot of conversations. I think that every night there's a hockey game, there's a thread between Yarmo and I talking about plays in the game and talking just talking hockey.
You have the sickness, like you said.
Yeah, we got the sickness. We got the disease. And, as my wife said, you've assumed the position. TV's on. TV's on. TV's on. And you're watching hockey. But, you know, let's give our amateur guys a lot of credit for the guys that they have drafted. I mean, we don't get to see as coaches. It's not a lot like football. I think football gets to see a lot more of what the player they may draft. Mm. We don't. I mean, there's an amateur scout gets to see a guy, a young man, when he's maybe 15, then 16. And he gets to see the growth. And then because he's been an amateur scout for X amount of years, he can go, boy, this is on the same track as this guy.
Yeah.
You know, I could walk in and I could watch 5 minutes of maybe one of the top picks and go, that guy's a good player. But I don't even know who they're playing against. Is that a good team? Is that a good player they're playing against? These guys have this bank of information that they've been doing for years. Now they got, boy, he took a big step this year. You should see the size of his dad. Boy, his dad's a big man. His dad's, wait till this kid. This kid's only 16. He's going to grow into this. So all that stuff is outside of our realm as coaches. But I can just look at the guys we've drafted, look at where they're at now, and you've got to trust these guys to do a good job. It's an exciting time for them. Now it's their time.
Yeah.
It's their time to excel, and They'll go through interviewing young kids. There's been the odd time I'll pop in on some of these interviews. I can remember being in a room when Charlie McAvoy was here being interviewed.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, see, there's guys that you remember. There's some young kids that you...
When you what,
I remember a lot of them, too.
Yeah.
I mean, Charlie was easy. Matt Boldy stood out to
me.
Like they're
You know, you walk out, and there's some that you kind of laugh when they walk out.
Yeah.
You know, there's some you think, boy, these kids are trained well. You know, the agent has told them to say this, and the answers are all the same.
Yeah.
But the amateur scouts said, watch him, you know, X number of games during the year, and I've got a real good handle on him. But background work, you know... Yeah. You know, parents, what's the kid like? What's his character
like?
Brother, sister, everything is, it's all good stuff.
Thank you for coming by today. This is very generous of your time, and we look forward to more down the road.
Yeah, always great being here.
Lindy Ruff, head coach of the Sabres, great start to the day. It continues with Shana Goldman from The Athletic next on Sabres Live.
Is your business struggling to be seen, not reaching the right customers?
Yeah.
Odyssey's here to help. Your one-stop shop for digital marketing.
Wait, really?
With targeted digital media, plus SEO, SEM, social, OTT, and more, we help your business reach the right audience and drive results.
Whoa, hey, one at a time.
Stop missing out on valuable customers. Visit digitallocalads.com to learn more about our local advertising solutions. That's digitallocalads.com.
Okay, people, line starts here.
I think Bo's still a young defenseman. He can get better. Rasmus Dahlin takes his job very seriously. He wants to be the best defenseman in the world. Samuelsson, to me, was probably the biggest revelation when I came here, how good he was. Watching from outside, I had no idea how good he can be and how good he was this year on both sides of the puck. He can still keep getting better. I have no doubt about that. Owen Power, such a talented young man, and he's just scratching surface. With that size, 6'6", I don't think he's ever going to be a killer, but he doesn't have to be. He's so smart, so mobile for a guy that size.
Sabres general manager Jarmo Kekalainen during his exit press conference talking about the Sabres' top four defensemen. All of them are under contract, at least till next year. Bo Byram, though, is the one that next comes up in terms of having to get paid. And a little bit later on there as well, boy, Jarmo sounded very excited to get those talks underway with Byram. And I imagine they're going to get that done as soon as possible. Don't know yet, though, about Tuck. A lot of the reports are both parties want to stay together. The price has to be right.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the issues are going to ultimately kind of ruin it. I don't imagine Tuck as a Sabre next year.
It's going to be an interesting conversation, but I guess we can ask our next guest this and plenty more. Travis Yost joining us here on the Westshore Hotline, and this appearance came about because Friday we were having fun talking about Jason Robertson, and I thought of Travis as we made a lot of like of those kinds of dreams a year ago, and now we're like, it's funny how some things never change though, Travis.
They don't, and I don't know why you're so interested. He couldn't even make an Olympic team. I mean,
that is right. He was maybe...
I like my Olympic snubs.
He was maybe the guy. I mean, you have the Montreal duo of Hudson and Caulfield, but Robertson, I think, for like most hockey fans, was like, all right, enough, guys. Like, he's big enough. He scores like the win. Like, we need the high-end talent. But they do win the gold medal, so I guess we can't complain too much, Travis.
Amen to that. I mean, he was honestly the only one I thought that was a genuine snub, but it was like a three sigma snub. He's like a top four American scorer the last 3 years. It's like, yeah, we don't need 80 goals. Sit at home. That's great.
Stay home. We're going to be just fine. Travis, on that though, I mean, because on Friday we were really looking at, you know, where the Sabres sit cap wise. They're expected around to have $12.9 million this offseason. Dallas, though, is expected to have under $6 million. They have a ton of their core already under contract. It's Robertson is sort of the one everyone's looking at. And I know there's already been discussions around him for, I think, the last year and some change of, you know, will Dallas trade him? What will happen there? I just, you know, I think a Sabres team that maybe needs more a little oomph in their lineup, Robertson just seems like such a good idea. But it would be, if you're going to trade for him, giving up a lot.
Yeah, and also, like, I got to say, I think there's a tie-in here, certainly, with Alex Tuck. I mean, you're talking about winger in, winger potentially out. And quite frankly, my base case, although I wouldn't say wholly confident in this direction, but my base case is that Buffalo is going to let Tuck walk, and not because they want to necessarily, but I mean, you're talking about a player who's probably going to command $8.5-9 million a year and on a cap hit on a multi-year deal. He's 30 years old. You've probably gotten the best or close to the best of Tuck at this point in his career. They're talking about this Byram extension. They've got to take care of Zach Benson. Mm-hmm. It does make you wonder if there's, whether it's Robertson or another player around the league, if there's an acquisition opportunity for this team to maybe deploy some picks and or prospects. And I, you know, this is a pretty mature team, which is crazy to say, but I mean, the opportunity for Buffalo is here and now, right? And so they've got to both get better this offseason while still dancing around the cap. And, yeah, could they bring back Tuck and really run it back and then kind of tinker at the margins? I think that's a completely defensible strategy. But, you know, whether it's Robertson, I talked at the trade deadline. I know there was a lot of Robert Thomas smoke because Buffalo really needs another – I think they would love to get their hands on another center, but – I honestly thought Jordan Kyrou would have fit in, you know, seamlessly to this lineup, the Sabres top six, top nine. That's another winger and a notable winger that is a 30-plus goal scorer reliably with a lighter cap hit that you could squeeze in really and still add around the rest of the roster. So, I mean, I can imagine Yarmo's excited, not the least, not to just get the Byram extension talks going underway. I think he sees a real opportunity to improve this team, and he doesn't have a ton of cap space, but he's got just enough to make things interesting this summer.
Just enough to make things interesting, Travis. And, you know, one of the names that got floated out there earlier in last week was, you know, do the Sabres need to upgrade goaltending? What would you think about, like, a Connor Hellebuck or the Sabres making a trade to try to upgrade in the net? I think they're okay there. It's not a popular sentiment, but I also know that that's not a popular sentiment. What do you think about the Sabres in the net mining situation?
I think they're one of probably 8 to 10 teams in the league where if opportunity knocks, you open that door. But, you know, if you can't – golden rule of goaltending, if you cannot acquire a guy who – and I'm not talking about even – like, Hellebuck is the tip – you know, the top-tier, upper echelon, first-ballot Hall of Fame goaltender that you're acquiring. That is really the top cut of that group. But – if you cannot identify a very reliable goalie, a goalie who you know is going to give you 90-91% save percentage year over year, even in a down year, he's still okay. In an up year, he's fantastic. If you can't identify with high confidence who that goalie is and how he's available and how you're going to acquire him, whether it's trade or free agency, you're seeing teams regularly, to varying effect, by the way, but regularly say, you know what, we're going to deploy our capital at the forward and defensive positions where we have much more confidence in what's out there, and we're going to be comfortable running a platoon. Now, I would emphasize that strategy was disastrous for the Sabres up until this year, and this year, and Alex Lyon was a big piece of that, I think, they found stability through journeyman guys, right? It was a lot of guys, you know, a guy like Lyon, he's been bounced around the league for quite some time, and, you know, I would say he's not a backup quality goaltender. I don't think he's a, you know, a 55 game starter either. He's kind of in that in between. It's where a lot of teams have looked at over the years. I mean, look at the Vegas Golden Knights, Carolina Hurricanes, I guess a little bit more with Freddie Anderson, but Golden Knights, I mean, that's been a you know, rearranging the deck chairs every single year. And in that, and they land on Carter Hart. I know that there's a different story there, but like a lot of these cheap, hey, let's see if we can just figure this out and put a great roster in front of the goaltender. You're seeing that in different pockets around the league right now.
I mean, Vegas does win their cup with Aiden Hill in net. So, I mean, it's not like it hasn't fully worked for them multiple times now. Vegas is sort of the one I look at with that. I mean, they've gone through different goalies. Like Travis, for me, we were talking about this last week. I'm almost in this vein with football too. Like with the Bills, I'd much rather draft receivers and trade for a pass rusher, right? I mean, the Bills do kind of the opposite. They go and trade for a receiver and they draft pass rushers. But in hockey, I'd much rather trade for the skaters and just draft every year a goaltender until I find somebody. And like you mentioned it, like we're already seeing too, these teams are rolling out platoons, and then around the playoffs, they hope one of their guys gets hot and stays hot. You're seeing that now with Montreal, with Jakob Dobesh. Like we can get now, I guess, into the conference finals at this point. But Dobesh, I think, has been the reason why Montreal is not getting blown out in these games. They've lost the last two, but it's been in overtime, and I think a big part of that has been how good Dobesh has been.
I mean, they've been outshot 92-47 in three games.
It's not great.
I think last night was like 38-13 in overtime. I mean, it's been that series has went exactly to plan, and that's no disrespect to Montreal, but Carolina is just dominating the puck, and if Montreal didn't have a high-end goaltender in net, this series would be 3-0, and the Bruins would be dancing around Raleigh right now. And by the way, back to your point, I think it's a very defensible one about your draft and trade strategy respective to the positions. One of the, it's the ultimate paradox for every NHL organization. It's goaltending is the single most important factor in terms of being deterministic about is it a great team, a good team, or a poor team. You find me a bad team in the NHL, I'll show you bad goaltending. Mm-hmm. That saying has been true for 100 years. It's still true today. The problem is it's a confidence challenge. When you see a high-end forward, like mentioned Jason Robertson, Jordan Kyrou, Robert Thomas, Alex Tuch, year after year after year, independent of intra-season volatility, they produce like top six players, right? Very similarly true, if you can identify a top four defenseman, get him in your lineup, the environment's right around him, he's generally going to play like a top four defenseman. The goaltending is the ultimate wild card, and absent a few guys like Hellebuck, Shesterkin, I used to, you know, sing the praises of Darcy Kemper because of how reliable he was for so many years, but it's a very short list of guys who have predictable outcomes. And the reason why that's so important is the moment you're ready to deploy $8, $9, $10 million of salary cap hits to one goaltender on your team, and that goaltender underperforms even the league average, you have a nightmare scenario. And a lot of teams, a lot of smarter organizations, they have not abandoned the goaltending, the position, quite opposite, but they have been much more conservative with their investment into the position, very similar to running backs in the NFL, right? It's like everyone wants a great running back, but how much are you willing to pay a guy? Not, you know, in running backs in the NFL, it's short shelf life, injury risk, et cetera. Goaltending volatility at that position, the performance volatility is so significant and extreme that if you sign a goaltender to a bad deal and one that anchors your team and also limits your ability to invest in front of him, that's a death sentence for basically any GM in the league. And even a team like Vegas, I mean, you mentioned Aiden Hill, like they won a Stanley Cup with him. He was an absolute nightmare this year. Mm-hmm. But because his cap hit was relatively manageable, all they did was bury him, look around the league. Akira Schmidt came in and plugged that gap for a period of time. Carter Hart's come in and he's played well for Vegas. And it's like, they're not the Golden Knights, this story of the playoffs, it's not like, and I wrote about this on Monday, it's not that their goaltending has been great. It's been average to slightly above average, but the team in front of him is so freaking good that that's really only what they need. They just need a goaltender who's not going to outright lose them games, and it's working for them as well.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about your thoughts on what the conference finals have been at large right now, Travis, as Carolina takes a 2-1 series lead in the East, and then Vegas. What's up with Colorado?
This is not, by the way, not the first time that Vegas has, as the underdog and consensus underdog, taken out Colorado deep in the playoffs. I remember this happening in 2021, and if you guys remember that team, I don't think that was as good of an Avs team, but man, did they play with a crazy pace and tempo that scared every team in the league, and yeah. Vegas met them in the second round and took care of them no problem. And the thing about Vegas is, they are, if you can guarantee, easier said than done, right? But if you can guarantee that goaltending isn't going to sink them, I mean, look at the personnel that they have available to them. I mean, the article I put up on TSN this week was basically three reasons why Vegas is up 3-0 against Colorado. And there really is four reasons, right? The fourth reason that I didn't really talk about is Cale Makar is playing at like 60%, and now Nathan MacKinnon's hurt too. And that, I mean, they talk about an absolute doomsday scenario for the Avalanche, but like, look at the Golden Knights penalty kill, which, by the way, has only been outscored 5-4 in the postseason, which is utterly ridiculous. They can run two regular pairings on the penalty kill and put Jack Eichel, Mitch Marner, and Nick Dowd, one of those three forwards or two of those three, depending on how they set up, on the ice at any given time. And it's like, you're going to put Eichel and Marner and Shea Theodore and Braden McNabb, that's your penalty killing unit? Yeah, of course you're only being outscored 5-4. This is about as good of a penalty unit as it gets. They have what Vegas has done, and the Golden Knights story has been written for the last decade. It's almost nauseating at this point, but they have done such a great job. not just roster building, but the continuance of roster building. This, and by the way, like Mitch Marner, not just the favorite for the Conn Smythe, the prohibitive favorite. Yeah. I think it's almost even money that he's going in as a favorite. And this is a guy, you know, I think he was unfairly written off in Toronto for lots of reasons. But, like, if there was one knock on him, it's like, oh, he's not a playoff performer, especially when the moments get tight. And it's like, oh, yep, just drop him in Vegas, have him play with good line mates and in an insulated lineup where he doesn't have to get fed to the meat grinder, you know, against the best, for example, in this Colorado series, it's Eichel's been taking the McKinnon minutes. So Marner's getting second line opposition minutes against Brock Nelson and his line. And Mitch Marner looks like a Goliath in these minutes. So it's, you know, a lot of it is like team chemistry, roster building, putting guys in the right environment. But Vegas, Carolina, Colorado, and I, you know, respect Montreal, but those three teams, is it really a surprise that these three teams are in the Final Four? And we're looking now likely at a Carolina Vegas Stanley Cup. You know, with as unpredictable as this sport is, you step back for 15 seconds and you're like, yeah, okay, if Colorado does kind of go bottom up randomly, what's your Stanley Cup pick? It probably would have been Carolina Vegas. So
yeah, and that's right. Colorado, by the way, they're gonna have some conversations here pretty soon about the age of that roster as well. I mean, some of the trade acquisitions they at certain spots are very, very old. And then for Vegas now, maybe their biggest question, Travis, and the last thing here, do you have to bring back John Tortorella if they make the Stanley Cup final? I feel like you have to.
I borrowed a quote from Major League last week. I think there's a curse word in the middle of it, but it's basically he's got to win the whole thing, right? I mean, yeah. The thing about Tortorella is, I mean, imagine you're Tortorella's boss, okay? Imagine you're Kelly McCrimmon. You're in the Vegas front office. On one hand, and by the way, I thought the firing of Bruce Cassidy late in the season, as strange as it was, not only does it fit exactly with Vegas's like bloodlust, the only thing we care about is winning. I lean into that. I think that's fine. I thought his termination was fine. I was shocked that they hired Tortorella, and I have had to eat some crow here because he's impressed me with the way that he's kind of stepped back, and it made me realize that, you know, a lot of what we think about Tortorella, not everything, but a lot of what we think about him is square peg, round hole, because he's been coaching teams like Philadelphia and these very young rosters that it's like oil and water to a guy like Tortorella. Look at this Vegas roster. He's coaching Jack Eichel, Mark Stone, Mitch Marner. I mean, it's just veteran Rasmus Anderson's veterans all over the place. He's clearly taken I could take a bit of a more of an executive type role behind the bench here. And if I got to light him up, I'll light him up. But I think these boys know how to handle themselves. It's fit very well. The other side of that coin is, he single-handedly has cost the organization the second-round pick, and it's not like Vegas has a lot in terms of prospects and picks because they trade them all away all the time. So I had thought that if they lost to Colorado here in the conference final, it would have been a handshake, a thank you to John Tortorella for stabilizing the season, job well done. But we're not going to guarantee your job at this point. We're going to look around because, you know, we want a longer-term fit here. And, you know, your media antics have cost us significantly, blah, blah, blah. I think if they run the table, and at this point, I think if they reach a Stanley Cup final, there's a real possibility that Tortorella was back next season and beyond, which crazy to have imagined a month ago, but here's where we are.
It really is. Travis, we got to run, but thanks so much for jumping on with us today. And, of course, we'll be plugging your stuff over at TSN, man. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, take care, guys.
Thanks, Travis.
Travis Yost there on the Wester Hotline. Covers sport over on TSN. And, yeah, they are finding themselves in a conundrum. But I'm kind of with Travis. You make a cup final. I think you have to have a real serious conversation, even if you lost your second-round pick. You got Eichel. You got Hanifin. You got Marner. Keep on running it back. It's just – it is wild how that series has turned. And again, Colorado just looking – just completely outclassed by Vegas. 803-0550, the number to call. We've got to take a timeout here. We'll be right back. This is WGR.
I'm Anna Garcia, host of True Crime News, the podcast. Every week, we bring you in-depth coverage on cases making headlines, as well as those that go under the radar. Tune in for Murders That Defy Explanation, Mystery Seeking Exploration, and Shocking Secrets That Will Leave You Breathless. Each week, we honor the victims by going beyond the salacious in our search for justice. Crime never stops, and neither do we. Listen to True Crime News, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
games, and I don't know. Some people like to jump out of airplanes. For me, this is my idea of fun.
Box score spelunking.
Yes.
That's the thing you like
yes.
to do.
Yeah. Yes. This is my idea of fun. And I'm doing it at work. What a life.
They pay us and everything.
Luke Fox with us from Sportsnet as we are well into the playoffs now. Sadly for us, the Sabres didn't quite get here, but great run. Luke, you were around for some of this, right? I wonder what, as I don't remember talking to you in quite a while here, and we had these drought years that seemed to last forever, but Buffalo, on and off the ice, seemed to be pretty back this year.
Oh, 100%. And I just think it's so fantastic for the city to see that everyone rally around the Sabres. And, man, I mean, they were one of the final five teams playing, and the margins are so thin, right? Like, maybe if they had dressed a better goalie, they'd be where the Montreal Canadiens are right now. Like, they gave it everything they had, and they just came so close. So, yeah, I was able to make it down, drove down from Toronto to Buffalo for games five and the heartbreaker that was game seven. And but I'm just so impressed, you know, especially the way the Sabres season started. It felt like, oh, no, here we go again.
Yeah.
You know, the drought's going to continue, but they turned themselves into an absolute wagon. They seem to really bond together. And I went into that dressing room after they lost game seven, and the heartbreak was real. And the belief was real. Like, you know, I got a chance to talk to Tage Thompson. He was like, even in overtime, we thought we were going to do it. We thought we were the better team. But this should only make them stronger going forward now that they've gotten a taste.
Yeah, I'm sure we must have touched base with you once the Sabres turned their season around at least once, Luke. I hope anyway. We thought to call you when they were like getting good.
Yeah, we did. I think
right.
we did.
Good. Right. But I wonder if like the difference from then to now even is like, because the team shows up out of nowhere. There was a lot of skepticism. You know, there was the river hockey thing after they beat Tampa 8-7 in the game of the year that one time, you know, coming out of the Olympic or heading into the Olympic program. I don't remember the timing, whichever. Anyway, and I think even I do this with teams that I'm not following day-to-day like I do the Sabres. You see a team get high, like, oh, that's not real. That's not sticky. Do you think this is sticky for them? I mean, they've got things they have to do, Alex Tuch front and center. But do you think that they, like, pass the test of looking like a contender going forward?
I do, and that's because I think they're still a relatively young group, and I think, Alex Tuch, there's a definite uncertainty there, and if, you know, he decides to go to the highest bidder, I'm not sure that's going to be Buffalo. Like, if all he ends up caring about is setting his family up with the biggest payday possible, that might mean moving on just because of the market and guys of his caliber are so few and far between. But, you know, outside of that, you got Zach Benson and Peyton Krebs, RFA, you know, surely there's a path to get those guys at a reasonable number, even if you have to bridge them. And then you got the core locked up at very reasonable numbers. And, you know, a guy like Josh Stone is just coming into his own. It seems like Rasmus Dahlin continues to find a level every year above his previous level. He was on my Norris ballot this year. So I do think their core is young enough, and this should provide a spark. And, you know, it's funny how fast things can change, because the first time I went down to Buffalo for a game, probably fall, early winter, a lot of the scuttlebutt was, you know, this is probably Lindy's last year, and maybe he'll just slide into a front office role or take a half step back, and then all of a sudden, you know, he's one of the best coaches of the whole season, and he signs a 2-year extension, and the players are professing their belief in him, and likewise, you know. I do think there's something special that happened this year that can continue.
Would you be willing to elaborate on that in terms of how you think they did it? This is a question we've asked of various analysts this season, as we ourselves have tried to be able to answer it intelligently. Like, There was the Kevin Adams move. You know, you talk about Ruff, for example. It's not cut and dried, is it? Right? Because we're almost 2 months into the season, and I don't know where this is going. And is he too old for this? Is he going to go upstairs? We heard kind of the same rumors. I even thought it was going to happen at one point with Ruff, and then it didn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, different people have offered different theories on how the Sabres did it, you know, how good. Maybe one would be, or certainly one would be, that the roster was always good enough, but then there was a different level of commitment, maybe, that a switch was flipped there. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's one specific thing. I think there's a number of things, and I also think momentum plays a big role. Like, once they, you know, you point to that Tampa game, right? Like, once they have a couple big wins, belief starts to grow, and that's a very real thing. But I do think there's something to the Kevin Adams thing, and you're like, well, you know, Kekalainen didn't really do any big moves. It's not like he splashed with a monster trade or anything. But I had heard, you know, through various people that, you know, there was, how do I put it, like a lack of belief in his vision for the team. And that changed once they made the change at a GM. And it's really an unusual situation because usually – I mean, we're seeing it in Vegas right now. Usually it's a coaching change that sparks a group. So it's kind of funny to think, you know, someone so far removed from the dressing room as a manager of making a change at that level would have an effect. But I you know, many people within those walls told me that had a real tangible effect. And then another thing, you know, I talked to Darlene once about was, you know, they started like really getting to like each other. I think there was a little bit of just checking in, you know, like it's like you go to work, but you don't hang out with your fellow work employees outside of office hours. They started going for more dinners together, he said. And, you know, he had that great line about, you know, we had beers. I think they hashed it out and they kind of maybe aired some grievances and kind of figured out, you know, as a young group, we got to find some answers within our room. And you know, they tried to find other ways. Like, even though the trade didn't go through, maybe it sent a message to them that they tried to bring in a Parayko, that they were kicking tires on a Robert Thomas. When you see your front office, you know, showing that belief by trying to add to your group with some of the bigger names that were supposedly available at the trade deadline, that probably instills a little bit of confidence as well. So, you know, we'll see where it goes because, unfortunately for the Sabres, they're kind of coming into their own at the exact same time as Montreal. Florida, we know, is going to come back bigger and stronger than they were last year. And the Atlantic, to me, is still the stronger division in the East. So it's not going to be easy, but I think the signs are encouraging.
Luke Fox, NHL writer with Sportsnet on the Western Hotline with us here on WGR. What would you do with Tuck? Would you pay the whatever, the Kempe contract or more? Or do you think it might be prudent to let a 30-year-old player ride off into the sunset and not have those regrettable years on the back end of what would probably be a big, long term commit.
Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
And it's not that long ago since that team had one of those, right? I'm thinking about Jeff Skinner, yeah. Right? You know, you pay, it's a tricky thing. And I think what Buffalo has actually done very well is getting ahead and betting on guys like Darlene, like Josh Stone. There's some, you know, Tage. Like there's some guys where it was like, we want to buy the prime years. Now, Tuck, there's an emotional factor, right? I firmly believe that he's incredibly beloved in that room. I know he doesn't wear the C, but he's probably right up there in terms of leaders in that group. And then he's got the home area ties as a Western New Yorker, so that makes it tough. And you hate to see talent walk out the door for nothing. I mean, there was no way you could have traded them in the season that they had, but it looks like bad asset management if you let them walk. But I think there has to be a limit. I heard him say that he wants to play till he's 40 years old. And it's not like he's a one-trick pony. His defensive capabilities as a forward are very strong. But, you know, I think you get into tricky territory when you're probably paying top dollar for the back half of someone's career. And that could bite you down the road. So it's not going to be an easy one, I don't think, for the player or for Kekalainen, this negotiation. But I think you have to set a limit. And I don't know if I'd go eight figures on an AAV. I might do 9 point something, but I think you can't overextend yourself because you got to get. There's going to be other options on trade or what have you. And if you keep your cap flexibility and you maybe invest, maybe make a bigger bet on Benson. I mean, I loved his playoffs. Maybe you bet a little bit more on him and don't bridge him and try to spend some of that cap money instead on locking him up for longer. So there's options here. But what great problems to have. Before it was like, where do you start? Now it's just like one or two guys you're trying to stick handle around. It's a much different conversation than what you guys are used to in the offseason.
No doubt about that. Benson, to the preface to your joining us, Luke, 5 misconduct penalties in these playoffs. Leads the playoffs in penalty minutes. He's been out for around...
Oh, he still does?
He still does. I think so. 64 is the number. 4th most misconducts in any playoff ever in the NHL history.
I didn't realize it was that
much. I know.
I didn't realize there were 5 game misconducts.
Game misconducts.
Just misconducts,
period. Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty crazy. You know, my feelings on Tuck, Luke, are very similar to yours. I think one thing that might, and we've had this conversation today and a lot here, Bulldog and I, that might push against that is the Sabres have a, respectfully, long history of their best players leaving. Like, that's kind of right there at the, like, chapter 2 in Sabres history behind, like, the existence of the team is chapter 1 would be all the names through the years of guys that have left. I would say
And then they win cups, unfortunately.
Right, right. No, right.
Recently, salt in the wound. That's right.
Brian Hart and Eichel. And, right. Yeah.
O'Reilly.
Yeah.
Conn Smythe winner. Salt in the wound.
Yeah.
So do the Sabres care about that in this moment? I think it's almost been, well, I can't say that because these are recent examples. I wanted to say I think it's almost been too long for them to have to worry about it. But if they're trying to establish a certain standard financially, maybe this is where they go, well, we know this is probably a bad contract in the long term, but we want to kind of what Darcy tried to accomplish by matching that offer sheet with Vanek. Like, you can't just sort of walk all over us. This is different than that. But I wonder if that would enter into their considerations.
Well, I'm sure they've spun it around, looked from all angles. What I would say, though, is to me, their window is just beginning, and it could be a long window. If this was towards the end, you could probably make a better case for re-signing him at top dollar and saying, well, we got to win now anyway. We can't let talent walk out the door. Who are we going to find to replace him? This is our chance. But to me, this is a longer window. And to make that kind of investment, you got to be pretty careful because you don't want to be hamstrung if something else becomes available or one of your prospects, you know, starts to shine and then now you get handcuffed. You know, I think about what happened to the Edmonton Oilers. You know, they tied up some money, big money in a guy like, say, Darnell Nurse. And then Broberg comes along and it's like, well, we don't have any money to pay this defenseman because we paid the older guy. So, like, sometimes there's something that you don't see coming that you want that money available for. So you got to be careful here. And, you know, if you're Yarmo, maybe you really try to shave off $1 or $2 million and try to play into Tuck's, like, hey, you're happy here. You're a good fit here. Your teammates love you. The city loves you. you know, if you go into the 10 million plus, near 11 million, it's a different kind of pressure. Like, you know, then you become a bit of a lightning rod. Right now, you're a hero. I think he got a bit of an easy pass considering he got 0 points in that round. You know, but if he was a $10 million player, he's probably getting less of a pass. Do you know what I'm saying?
For sure. Yeah, no doubt. The question is, like, we're so much of what you talk about with a player at his age, 30, and a 7 or 8 year contract, which only the Sabres can do before July 1st, is, you know, you watch a playoff series and you're waiting. I was waiting at locker cleanout to hear what his injury was. And he said there was nothing. Some nuisances is all he said he had. And because I thought there had to be something that would explain, there wasn't, I mean, obviously he had 0 points, but there were just in the games, I thought often you just, if you noticed him, it was because he was getting walked around. It wasn't like he was making plays and real close to me. There was one good chance in game 7 off a rebound. That was really it. And so you worry, is the cliff already here? Did we just get a sneak preview of the cliff? Because that would be horrible. Like, it's one thing to bite off a long-term deal at a cap figure that you can barely tolerate if you get 3 or 4 good years on the front end of it. But if, like, we're already at the cliff and don't know it yet, holy cow, buyer beware.
Then it's a poso.
Right.
Yeah, you may have already gotten his best years and you don't know it. And I think he's a hard worker and, you know, he's not going to just kick his feet up once he gets his payday, whether that's in Buffalo or elsewhere. But, you know, Father Time is undefeated. And the thing is, it's like, you know, he was great in the Boston series. He produced there. But I think he's responsible and he's got like the intangibles in terms of character and leadership and good in the community and all that. But once you're making 10.5, you better be a game breaker. And is he going to be a game breaker at age 33? You know, if this is a 7 or 8 year deal and he's in the middle of the deal, is he going to be game breaker worthy, payday worthy? I don't know. And that's a decision that they're going to have to make. I mean, Nikolaj Ehlers, right? He's to me the Nikolaj Ehlers maybe of this class in terms of the best winger that's available and that might end up on a different team. And, you know, Winnipeg may be regretting it. Like, it's going to be a gamble either way.
A couple minutes left with Luke Fox, if you have it, Luke. Just looking around the league a little bit, get to the rest of the playoffs, but how about the Leafs? So we're getting the coaching change that was not necessarily a given after the way the start of the offseason sounded. How big a lift do the Leafs have to get good again?
It's big. You know, winning the draft lottery is a massive jolt of hope in the fan base that was pretty down after a 30-point decline year over year. And then rumors of, is Matthews really happy? And, not everyone was thrilled with in the market with the choice of going with John Chaykin as GM, kind of a off the board hire, not a big proven name. So that injected a lot of hope and life into the city and into the group. But I think just hockey wise, you look at these playoffs, it's fast. And the Leafs played a slow brand of hockey this past season. They're getting a little older. A lot has to break their way. They need their goalies to be healthy. They need Chris Tanev to come back to camp ready to go. They need Austin Matthews, his knee to heal, one, but also get back to being a 50-goal threat. He wasn't that, right? He didn't even get to 40 this past season. And then they need more mobility on the back end. They never truly replaced Marner as Matthews' winger. They need another top six winger. There's multiple holes in this roster. So that doesn't mean they can't turn it around in a few years, but the way Montreal is going, the way Buffalo is going, the way Tampa's maintained and Florida is expecting to bounce back, They're going to be in a dogfight, I think, just to make the playoffs next year.
You mentioned not replacing Marner, and all he does is help Vegas sweep the best team in the league this year in the conference final. I saw this through Greg Wyshynski by way of Sean McIndoe, I think. Maybe in a few years, the Leafs can bring Marner back as a grizzled winner. That'll go over well, right?
No brainer.
Everyone's got their zingers on Marner regarding Marner's success. It is wild, though. Like right now, he's the Conn Smythe favorite. He never won three rounds in 9 years in Toronto, and he's already won three rounds in his first year in Vegas. You can't write this stuff.
That's very relatable. That's the the point from earlier about the Sabres who left. Whose cup is it? Vegas is in the final. They're obviously live to win, but is Carolina maybe too good?
I think if Freddie Anderson can, continue to play well enough, I feel like Carolina's the deeper team. And I think it's going to be a fantastic final because, Montreal could still upset. I just, they're getting 12.
They're kind of being overwhelmed.
That recipe, and they already went seven twice. And it looks like if they're going to sneak through, they're going to have to go seven again. Like, I just don't see it. It's hard to, you never want to count a team out, but it's hard to see it. And Carolina is like very healthy. They bought into their identity. They just roll four lines. They roll 6D. They have a game plan. They stick with it. And eventually they generate enough chances that they seem to get by. But Vegas seems to be, if Carolina is a straight line in terms of consistency, Vegas has been on an incline. They were better against Anaheim than they were against Utah, and they were better against Colorado than they were against Anaheim. They have something special brewing there. And, I think credit to their goaltending, credit to Marner, I hate to say it on this station, but credit to Eichel and then to Tortorella. I mean, crazy for a team to make a coaching change that late and to have this quick success.
It is annoying. I dislike the precedent so much, just sort of as a, it's how I was raised a little bit. It doesn't seem fair that you get fired so late in the season like Cassidy did, but they weren't either that good. I mean, they were,
right.
Look at their record.
They're absolutely playing their, Mark Stone back matters a lot to that, but they're playing the best hockey of the season right now.
Yeah, got to admit.
What they're doing.
All right, Luke. Well, it's been great hearing from you again and spending time together. Thanks for this.
All right, thanks for having me on, guys. Have a good one.
You too. Luke Fox. Luke Fox Jukebox.
One of the best handles out there on the socials.
Bulldog calls it X.
Sometimes historic events suck. But what shouldn't suck is learning about history. I do that through storytelling. History That Doesn't Suck is a chart-topping history-telling podcast chronicling the epic story of America decade by decade from the 18th century to the 20th. Original music and immersive sound design accompany us on our storytelling journey. Listen to and follow History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
They're going to whack you for it. Kyrou in, they give him room, gets it back, quick shot. He shoots, save, rebound, score! Robert Thomas. And what a game of back and forth. Kyrou,
which they... NHL offseason upon us, not upon everyone. Vegas on to the Stanley Cup Final. St. Louis Blues had a strong finish to the season, and we're going to talk about it and see if the Sabres and the Blues want to link up again as they did around the trade deadline. Joining us on the Wester Hotline is Lou Korak, who covers the Blues for NHL.com, St. Louis Blues site editor at the Hockey News as well. Lou, good morning.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
We're all right, We're just sitting here watching Vegas in the Cup Final again, and, it is what it is. I don't know.
Yeah.
it's fine. It's a team that's existed for 9 years and has made three appearances in the Cup Final, and the Sabres have been there once in 50. So,
and we're not over Game 7.
That's right. We're still over here dealing with an overtime loss of Game 7 in the second round. Yeah, it's a complicated time of year, I guess.
Yeah, so. I watched that game from afar, guys. It was entertaining. I'm sure those that had a vested interest in that one were definitely on the edge of their seats. If for somebody like me watching from afar, I was definitely on the edge of my seat. And actually, I was pulling for the Sabres. I mean, just from the understanding of the futility that's gone on, and finally reaching the playoffs, and obviously going back to 2018 when the Blues and the Sabres linked up for that big Ryan O'Reilly trade, I was kind of thinking to myself, man, if Buffalo can make a run to the Cup final here and maybe even win it, I think you can, you finally see one of those trades where everybody talks about, you want to see both teams benefit from it one day. I was thinking, man, could this thing actually really go full circle here? What, 7-8 years later, that would have been something to see.
Yeah, and we almost saw these two link up for a trade. We kind of did, but of course, like Colton Parayko shut it down. But Lou, I guess the question on this would be, where are the Blues here in a life cycle of a team? Are they at rebuild, retool? Is that depending on what kind of offers come in? Because while Parayko ended up being the deal that was agreed to but not finalized, Robert Thomas rumors were out there quite a bit. So how do you view where the Blues probably think they are in like the timeline of an NHL team and what they should be doing right now?
They're never going to admit that they're in a retool. Let's put it that way. That's a word that Doug Armstrong has never used. And I don't even think he really uses retool a whole heck of a lot. I think that they feel like that. I don't even know if recycle's a word here that you can use, because they feel like, after last year, and they made quite a run to get in and should have knocked off the President's Trophy winning Winnipeg Jets until, you saw what happened in the last 2 minutes of regulation there and then ultimately losing in double overtime. They thought that they could run this thing back with the group that they had. And then when they got off to such a poor start, you're chasing again and you're having to kind of go through and do the same thing that you did. It was quite a disappointment, quite a shock. And I think that's why you got to a point there around the trade deadline, as well as you guys know, where, you're talking about the whole Colton Parayko situation, where really Doug Armstrong told his leaders at the time leading up to the trade deadline that nobody is safe. And it's his last year as GM. He's just going to take over he's been doing a dual role with the president of hockey ops and GM, and now he's just going to be president of hockey ops. I think he was just wanting to go out on a high note, and they know that they have a pretty good cupboard of prospects, but they also have guys in that age range where they can make a run and win. So I think that's kind of where you kind of put yourself in that murky middle situation where, are we good enough to make a run, or should we just, like you guys said, retool this thing or rebuild this thing? Because they've got a pretty good cast of prospects that are going to be coming through here and are going to be really good hockey players in the next handful of years. And it just depends on how, much some of these guys progress. So it's really a tough question to answer to you. I know I'm kind of giving you a roundabout answer here, but they'll never admit that they're in a retool. They're going to go into it again next year feeling like they can be one of those teams that can jump in and make a run and be one of the top teams or one of the top eight teams in the Western Conference and see where they go.
Yeah. Do you think if they hadn't gone on the run they had, that it would be a more clear answer to that question? Like they almost get in, and I wonder, Lou, if they had continued to maybe like collapse at the end of the season rather than rally and almost get into a spot, if maybe they'd be, it'd be a little easier to predict what they would do.
I think so. I mean, you're talking about guys like, they're really high on defenseman Adam Juracek. You've got Justin Carboneau, the forward that they drafted in the first round last year, that they're really high on. There's a number of guys. They played a lot of these young guys down the stretch that helped them go on this run again. But then you've got guys like Robert Thomas. And I'll be perfectly honest with you guys here. I don't think they were ever in a situation where they were going to trade Robert Thomas. I mean, he's 26, 27 years old. You're talking about a guy that's really getting into the prime of his career here. I think that situation there was one where they were listening. When you have a Doug Armstrong telling, his fellow peers that, everybody is, on the line, you're probably listening to other teams calling you instead of, soliciting such a player. But, I think it would have been more clear had they gone the path that they'd gone on the majority of the season, because it just wasn't very good. I mean, they were pre-Olympics. You know, this was a team that was, what, 30th in the league? So, I mean, I think that's a pretty good indication of what you need to do and where you need to go, because they were in a similar situation. And like you guys had mentioned, they went on a heck of a run to be able to get into the Western Conference playoffs, and we're knocking on the door once again. And I don't know if you want to call it false hope or not, but it was a situation where I think it was an understanding of these guys. They know what these guys are, and they know what they can give them. It's just a question of why can't they put forth those kinds of performances in October, November, December, January, when the games matter just as much as they do in February, March, and April. And that's 2 years in a row that they've done it this way now.
You mentioned that maybe they never came really close to trading Thomas. Will the GM change? Would you expect change anything with Armstrong going in and or coming out and Alex Steen coming in? Do you feel like it would be the same situation, that the odds of him being dealt wouldn't be that high just because the new guy's coming in?
You know, that's an interesting scenario there. And you know what? I think it would become a little bit more clear in that regard, because Alex Steen and Robert Thomas were teammates. There's a connection there. There's a connection there, not only in that regard, but there's other players. Pareko's one of them. I don't know how much that's going to change, because, you know, what Steen's been able to do here for the last 2 years, he's been able to sit back and sort of learn and absorb some of the things that Doug Armstrong does. So does he come in and do things his way? I'm not so sure, because, you know, just because of the fact that this is going to be all new for him, and he's going to have Doug Armstrong by his side. Don't get me wrong. Just because Doug Armstrong is stepping away from a GM role, don't think for a second that, you know, it's going to be a situation where, hey, he's going to go, hey, Alex, you do what you got to do, and I'm just going to sit in the background. There's going to be some learning curves here for Alex Steen, being a first-time GM. But, you know, being able to sit back for the last 2 years, you might see him come in and deal in a style that Doug Armstrong would. So I'm kind of interested to get his perspective on that. And we'll get a chance to talk to him, because once July 1st rolls around, the keys are going to be handed to him. And Doug Armstrong has made that perfectly clear. He's not going to step on Alex Steen's toes. He's only going to jump in should he be asked to jump in. He's going to hand him the keys and say, the car is yours. It's up to you what you do with it now.
Luke Horak with us. On Colton Pareko, the deal that got, you know, close to happening, but he didn't want to do it. How did Pareko sound after he came back to St. Louis? They were on that West Coast trip. Did he buy back in pretty easily? I guess, what's the mood like around him and his future there?
You know, that's going to be another interesting one. And I'll be honest with you, Colton Pareko became a St. Louis lifer. I mean, you're talking about a guy that's now played 11 seasons here, drafted here, Alberta kid that turned really St. Louis into his second home. And I think I'm going to have a chance to talk with him here. I kind of wanted to let the dust settle. I've gotten close enough to him. I want to have a really chance to kind of sit down, let him decompress long enough and really get his perspective on the whole thing. Just my initial read on it is, I think he got thrust into a situation where he had to make a decision on a whim. Now, if he maybe had some time to really think about this, I think it was really a culture shock for him. I know he heard the words of Doug Armstrong that nobody is safe just because of the way that the team was playing. But when your name is actually called and said, hey, we've got a trade in place for you. This is where we want to send you. It's up to you now, you know, whether to waive your full no trade or not. I think it really caught him off guard. And when it was right around the trade deadline, you're talking about, hey, we need to know now. We need to know now. It's got to happen now. I think he just got caught into a situation where he really didn't have time to step back and think about this. It was going to be a complete life change for him. I don't think he was ready for it at the time. I don't think it had anything to do with the fact that it was going to Buffalo or not. I mean, the Sabres at the time were playing really well, and it was quite obvious that they were going to make the playoffs. And the way the situations were, the Blues were not going to get in, and the Sabres were. So I don't think it had anything to do with the fact that, oh, well, I'm going to Buffalo. No, I'm not going to do that. And I just think it was a situation where he needed some time to really think about this, and there really wasn't any. So I think that was more the case. So unfortunately, you know, it looks bad there. It almost, you know, to the fan base, I know there was some pretty negative feedback and reaction to, you know, well, if he doesn't want to come here, you know, we don't want him. So it's going to be a situation this summer that I think they're going to look at it and revisit it again. But this is one of those smoking guns where people don't understand when you give a player a full no trade, you got to understand the Blues already went through this. They went through this 3 years ago with Torrey Krug, where he nixed a trade to Philadelphia. So, and they could have had Travis Sanheim here. So that's the player's right. You have to understand that. And sometimes I think that the fan bases don't get that. You know, you're talking about a life change for a player, not only for a career, but this is a place that he enjoys. During COVID, you know, you're talking about an Alberta kid. This is a guy that stayed here in St. Louis and enjoys his time here, has loved his time here, and I just don't think he was ready to leave. And he's got two more years left of pretty much full power of deciding where he wants to go. But I think now that this has been out there, he's more willing to understand. He's had more time to process and decide, do I want to leave St. Louis, and is it the right situation for me? I think that's basically what it all boiled down to, as opposed to, at the time, no, I don't want to go to Buffalo.
Quickly resetting on him, if it did come back up and he was open to doing it now, what level of player would a team still be getting at him at 33?
I still think he's good. I mean, I know you can open up his stats page right now and see that his offensive stats were not as good as they were the previous season. I can give you an example. Theo Lindstein, who was a 2023 first round pick defenseman, one of the young players that they brought in that they kind of wanted to groom along here. Colton Parayko took him under his wing and made the transition for him fantastic. So they were a pair from the moment that Theo Lindstein came in here all the way down the stretch. And the Blues were comfortable putting him in a top four role because they knew they had somebody that they can rely on. This guy, he could still skate. He's still going to play 20 to 25 minutes a night. I think he averaged 22, 23 minutes. So his ice time was slightly diminished, but I think that was just because of the case that they wanted to look at some younger guys. So there's still a good hockey player there. He's going to be on the ice when called upon, when the opposition's top players are out there. That's something that Jim Montgomery was never going to waver away from, and he was comfortable enough in putting a young guy out on the ice knowing that he had a good buffer and a good veteran in Colton Parayko on the ice still. He's still a good hockey player. It's just a question of, you know, how teams are, you know, how teams on the outside are able to view him. But I can tell you from here, watching him day in and day out, he's still got a lot of hockey left in him.
Lou Korak covering the Blues for NHL.com. Lou, thanks very much for the time.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
So should I just, like, not think about Robert Thomas anymore? Or should I understand that the price is going to be significant because his salary is also really nice?
I'm willing
to
think
$8 million and five more years of contract.
It's really nice.
It's really, really nice. That's part of the price you pay is the contract.
Right. And he's at an age where I'm not really worried about it anyway. I'm willing to still entertain it just because the new GM could come in and see things differently. That's it. But I am also not like code red. He's getting dealt. You got to be the team to get him. Which is, I feel like, where we were maybe at the deadline. I don't know. Listening to that, it sounded like Parayko is much more likely to be dealt than Thomas.
Right.
Which, if I'm the Sabres, I don't really want to do that. Even though it was exciting at the time, like, the way the season progressed and the way the contracts are setting up, and if you want to pay Bo Byram, just I don't see how paying Parayko $6.5 million to be my number five defenseman makes any sense.
Can I give you the results of our Twitter poll about Byram today?
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I saw like the very early returns, okay, and Byram was ahead.
Who wants to guess? The Twitter poll I posted today was, who would you rather keep long term? And your options are Alex Tuch or Bo Byram. There are not that many votes in, only 324 votes in.
I'd guess like 65% are on Byram.
I'm going to bet it's higher than that. I think people are swinging away from the Tuch idea. I think it's just that it's becoming real. I'd guess 75% Byram.
It is 91-9.
Whoa.
Byram. Dang.
Hmm.
Whoa.
If Yarmo wakes up and checks Twitter, well, who?
I'm going to
91-9.
Retweet that on the station account, see if we can't get some numbers on there.
We're getting more numbers.
There we go. We got to get that. Let's see if that rate holds with a higher number of samples, because that's pretty interesting.
Is part of that that there's an assumption right now that Byram would cost multiple million dollars less than Tuck would?
I don't know why that would be assumed.
Because Tuck can get that on the open market and Byram can't right now.
Byram can in 1 year.
In a year he can.
Sure, but in 1 year, he's getting...
But I guess what's...
Is he not getting
the
seven figures?
Yes. But the person
eight figures? Sorry, eight.
The person's voting for Byram in that. What's the number for Tuck in their head right now?
11 million. 11
and a half. Okay, and what's the number for Byram in their head?
I don't know, but shouldn't it be 11?
It should be
nine
and a half.
I don't think people are thinking 11 for him right now. I think maybe they should, but I think the number for Byram feels like 8.5, 9.
All right, same exact
time. And I think that would be maybe presumptuous to say that he would settle for that. A year ago, there were reports from Elliot Friedman that he wanted to be a number one defenseman.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you want to be paid like a number one defenseman. So if you're
signed
up for not being that...
Yeah, and then he signed for reasonable money, six.
But if you're signing up to never be a number one defenseman on your team or never even be a number two defenseman, like... Do they have to make up for it with money? Like, I'd wonder that. Like, Malkin ended up getting more than Crosby at one point in time early in his career because I almost felt like there was a premium and you have to sign up to not be the guy on our team.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Draisaitl get more than McDavid? Like, I feel like there are there's spots in the league where you need to pay me to accept playing a lesser role than I could play on another team.
I think that is with more elite guys than this.
Byram?
I don't think Byram rates at that level where it's like, well, you know that I'm good enough to be
a number one defenseman.
I don't know that you know that about
right. Byram. And maybe 11's high, but in another full year with the cap going up to what by then? Like, you've got to start to expect salaries to just climb. A guy that's worth 9 today in a year is worth 10.5?
At least.
He'll be going into a year where it'll be $113 million.
And what is it now?
95.
I think if you could get in on that now before the explosion happened, like there is a group of, it's like Bedard, Celebrini, Carlson, Fantilli that are all going to get contracts here, and they're all going to get like $14 million, and the market is going to explode. So if you're able to get in before that happens... With a Byram deal, like even though those guys are all forwards and they're all elite, like different younger players, but like that will change how players are now paid. And that, like, you want to be ahead of that. That's why I think you get Benson when you can. Like, I do not want anything to do with a bridge on Benson. If you got to pay him eight, pay him eight for 8 years. I do not care. Give him whatever you need to give him because that price is never going to get cheaper for you. Never.
It's kind of like a football point, right? Like, where you're going to be punished more now for waiting.
Yes.
And that's been somewhat true already. Like, you've seen that, right? Thompson and Samuelson, not every spot. But, like, football, we know it's true. Like, what is the biggest criticism of the way the Dallas Cowboys do contracts?
I was just thinking them too.
They wait
too long.
As long as possible to sign Prescott or Pickens or whoever, and then those guys end up making $10 million more than they could have had them on. And I would agree with that on Benson. Like, you could, if you paid him $7 million now and you just get a 7-year deal, like, I'm good. Versus, all right, well, let's give you a 2-year deal and we'll push this down the road. And then, oh, wait, the cap went up $30 million. And now your peers are signing for $10 million. So now you're going to want $10
million. Mm-hmm.
So
I'd
be with that idea.
Have any interest in picking over the carcass of the Avalanche?
I would.
How about
what do you want?
Brett Kulak?
Kulak's nice.
UFA?
Nice player.
UFA, left shot, UFA. Yeah. I know everyone like wants right shot defensemen, but...
The Sabres have too many at
the
bottom.
So Brett Kulak, 32-year-old veteran defenseman. Who else is a free agent from them?
Jack Drury. It's like minor guys after that, really.
Yeah.
Brent Burns. He's very old.
41. 41 Brent Burns. And both their goaltenders are under contract.
Yeah, I don't need anything.
I don't really need anything at the fringes of the roster for them. Well, sorry, I need any third-pair defenseman. But they don't need a fringe forward.
No.
The only forward you would add would be at the top of the lineup.
Yeah, you
they
don't
are
add a
loaded
guy
with bottom six forwards.
Yeah, you've got guys chomping at the bit to take a bottom six role and hopefully score 25 goals for you because that's like you've got a bunch of guys that are ready to try to really wedge their way in.
That's why I'm also curious, like, what they'll do with Krebs. I don't think Krebs is going to cost much.
No.
Although he's going to want a raise off of a 40-plus point season that was a career year for him. Because what am I saying if I'm Krebs' agent? I'm saying, you just had your best season in 15 years, and he played on your top line almost the entire year.
Mm-hmm.
And had an amazing first round. I think he played more 5-on-5 minutes. Peyton Krebs did. More 5-on-5 minutes than any other forward on the team in round one.
Yeah.
So I'm going, I said 40 points. I played on the top line all year. I'm not going nuts, but you got to give me something. $3 to $4 million, and if I'm the Sabres, I'm looking forward and saying, yeah, but I don't think you're a top-line forward going forward,
yeah.
And I have a bunch of those, and I have a million bottom six guys. Like, I wonder if there's a relationship with him going forward.
I think that that's a tough one, because you've got, what's Krebs' strength? He's a guy that can go up and down your lineup and play the right way, whatever, blah, 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 which is absolutely valuable. How many of the young guys do you think are that in development with a higher ceiling? Like, is that not what Östlund is? Is that not what Benson even is? He did that this year for them, playing on the fourth line, and then the next game he's on the first line with Tage, and he's looking great. And it's like, I don't know how many of those guys do you need. And if the guys
ideally, you don't have many of those guys because your first line guys are so good,
exactly.
You wouldn't dream of putting them down there.
Right.
Like, it went well, but I don't want him on my top line forever. And with all the forwards they have, and we're talking about cap crunches and how do you keep talking, can we get rid of Greenway somehow? I'm going to add, what, $3 million for Peyton Krebs?
Yeah, I don't need to do that.
I like the player, and I thought that was his best season by far, but at some point, guys get pushed out, right?
Exactly.
And you got to prioritize who's part of your core. And I think it's very clear a guy like Benson is part of your core.
Yes.
I think it's very clear a guy like Krebs does not factor in on that level.
Right.
803-0550. Just came across a story at the Seahawks website, Seattle Seahawks, that, of course, they're trying to win the Super Bowl again, right? John Boyle, Seahawks.com senior reporter. The Seahawks open OTAs, because a lot of teams just opened OTAs. The Bills got out a week early.
Yeah.
Got in, I should say, a week early because of a new coach. So a lot of teams kind of went to OTAs this week. Seattle Seahawks coach Mike McDonald has, he's got a line here. Ready for this? Ready? What do you call it when you're trying to win again? Let's do it again.
Repeat.
Or?
Back to back.
You're close.
Repeat, back to back. Defend.
Run it back?
Let's run it back. Run it back.
Yeah.
Right? Let's run it back.
Yeah. Has he got a new phrase?
Yeah. They don't want to run it back. Quote, we're using the term we want to run it forward.
These coaches, man.
Right?
I like him, too.
Stop.
That's so corny.
Stop. Hold on.
Just had something like this.
Here's the full quote. We're using the term we want to run it forward. I think this is going to be a conversation we're going to talk about consistently. I don't think it's a one-and-done type of conversation. Really, it's just how we talk about how we operate all the time. It's something we're having conversations with our team and our units every day about who we want to be, how we want to do things, and this situation is no different. It's nothing more or less than that. Asked who came up with the new phrase, run it forward, McDonald smiled and said, if you like it, I'll take credit for it. If not, somebody else. Now, that I like.
Yes.
That's awesome.
We're not running it back because we never go back. Like,
I know what I was thinking.
It's incredibly lame.
Marty St. Louis said this in the Sabre series, didn't he? Bounce forward.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Oh, he did.
Remember,
did.
He said, we don't say bounce back. We say bounce forward in this locker room.
Mm-hmm.
These coaches,
oh, man.
Oh, man. Sometimes these coaches take themselves so just.
I will say there are times where like
run it forward,
run it forward.
They're gonna create T-shirts.
I've said stuff like that in the locker room and thought to myself, God, that was stupid.
Well,
like nobody in here thinks that was serious.
Well, you're really running a risk because when you come up with something like that and you introduce it in front of a locker room like that, and you know what if it doesn't land and you got 50 guys and they're like. Oh, so lame.
I got laughed at in a video.
So lame.
Time.
Yeah.
I did. I got up in front of the team and said something and they laughed at me.
Right, but that's good. Like, I think that's a good relationship. Like,
for sure.
If I'm McDonald, I want my players to laugh at me if they think it's lame. I don't want them to, in their heads, go, that's the worst ever. And they're like, hey, good one, coach. Good one. Oh, yeah, let's do that.
There's a notorious video out there of this little league team and this kid standing in the front of the bus. Guys, coach is right. If we're going to win, it's on us. All this cheesy stuff. And the kids just tell them to shut up and sit down. They all start yelling at him. No cheesy stuff on the bus.
Do the Bills have a slogan for this year?
This year, they do have a slogan for this year. Put the ball down.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That's what Joe Brady's saying. Put the ball down. That means anytime, anywhere, we're going to be ready to play. Put the ball down. That's what they're saying.
All right.
Okay.
Fine.
Put the ball down. Yeah, I guess that is what that means.
Yeah.
Yep. I did think of fumbling immediately before you'd explained it.
Right.
But that's more put the ball on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to do that.
No.
No.
You're okay putting it down, but not on the ground, even though they're kind of the same thing.
Yes, right.
All right. I mean, you run out of slogans. I mean, they've had 50 seasons, 65 seasons. There have been a lot of slogans. You run out at some point. You could repeat, like, probably. Like, who's going to remember the one from 20 years
ago? Being upset with saying run it back is like saying refuse to lose. We don't say the word lose around here, so we're not going to use refuse to lose. Like, okay, right. Okay. Refuse to be kept from winning. Okay, Mike McDonald, sure. Anyway, whatever. I thought it was a funny story.
Could they? How likely are they to win again?
To repeat? Fine.
They didn't really lose anything, right? They lost a Super Bowl MVP.
They lost their running back. They lost a couple pieces on their defense.
Yep. Their division is still great.
Yep. Yep. I mean, they were a coin flip from beating the Rams. First off, they should not have had home field advantage, which they did in the NFC Championship game, in a game they won by 4.
Right.
Because a Rams tight end dropped the pass. You know, like, so you got to get a little lucky along the way, and then they were dominant once they got to the Super Bowl. 803-0550. Jeremy and Joe on WGR.
Hey, this is Richard Deitch, the host of the Sports Media Podcast. If you're interested in what's happening with all the places where you consume sports, the Sports Media Podcast has you covered.
I've been turning down interviews all week. Hoda Kotb reached out, Oprah, George Stephanopoulos. So I said no. I was booked on the Deitch podcast before the Taylor Swift phenomenon. I must live up to my responsibility.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.